Daniel chapter 1. Listening time is approximately 52 minutes.
Last week, we looked at the first two major sections of our outline, the background and overview. We got the historical perspective where Daniel fits in. I think when we study any part of the scripture, it's good to see where it fits into the historical timeline. The secular world has an historical timeline also. I have a degree in history, but I never studied history, even though I went to a Christian college, from God's perspective. Isn't that a shame? God has a different perspective on world history, and all except up to the time of Abraham, world history revolves around one nation, and that is Israel. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I believe it.
Absolutely. There are the Gentile nations that are mentioned in the scriptures. We don't really hear a lot about the Japanese imperialistic period in the scriptures, or the Chinese when they were flourishing, or the Mongolian hordes of Genghis Khan that swept through Asia and into parts of Europe. We don't really hear that in the scriptures, and yet that went on. So we know that God didn't record everything that was certainly going to take place in the world, but he recorded that which we need to know, because our entire life eternally is related to the nation of Israel. And that's where God's whole plan of redemption was carried out through. Don't ever think the church has nothing to do with the Jews. The church started with the Jews, and there have always been Jews in the church. Somehow we, as, quote, Gentiles, have gotten the view that it's our thing. But if you are a true born-again believer through Jesus Christ, what family are you in from the world's perspective? Sure, we're in the heavenly kingdom, but what one? Yes. You are placed into that two ways. What two ways? It uses the analogy of the olive tree and the wild branches and such. Being what? When they tie branches together and they grow together, what's that called in horticulture?
Grafting.
We are grafted in. You'll find that in the Bible. But we're also what? What Marwin and I do?
Bonded.
Well,
adoption.
We're adopted heirs. The other are original heirs. But Jesus said there's neither bond nor free, Jew or Gentile, male or female. That doesn't mean when you become a Christian you cease to exist as a male or female. No. But he's saying we're all one in Christ. We got to grab hold of that. And that's what we want to do now with Daniel. And I'm going to just review a little bit, because you must get this into your mind as to God's view of history. Because some of it's already fulfilled, and some of it is yet to be fulfilled. And you can see it in the daily news. So we'll get to details later. But we studied it in Revelation when we went to Daniel about this statue. There's also other references to seven great Gentile nations or kingdoms or empires. History calls them empires. God calls them kingdoms. You want to name them because you really need to get those in your mind. Now, if you don't have them in the right order, it's fine, but let's start thinking of what they are. And I'll give you a clue. God's history is in the Mediterranean basin. What are they? Think of the Bible historically, where the Jews were at different times.
Israel was one of them.
Israel was not a Gentile kingdom.
Okay.
You're calling it Persia?
The
Medo-Persian were together. That's one of them. That's true. Babylon. Another
Baby
one?
Babylon.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Roman.
Greek. Assyrians.
What we call Assyrians. Syrians. Is that what they call Syria now, today?
We'll get to that. We're going back to the historical of that time. These were revealed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There are two more. Where did the nation of Israel really get established? The parting of the Red Sea.
Egypt.
That is 3, 6. Well, let's just take those for now. Which was the first?
Egypt.
Second. The Roman was the last of these. That was the time of Jesus. The kingdom split. Northern king was taken into captivity by the Assyrians. The Assyrians then were overpowered by the what empire that took the southern kingdom in captivity? It was Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian. The handwriting came on the wall with Nebuchadnezzar's son. And he said, your time is over, and I have who at the door? Darius the Mede. Persia, and the goat was, that was overdoing the ram? Greek. Have all these come and gone? Have they? Have these kingdoms come and gone?
Yes.
Yeah. They've all fallen. There's ruins. You go to Egypt, you see the ruins. So there's a nation of Egypt. There's no kingdom. There's a nation. The Assyrians are just Syria. Babylon is what country today predominantly?
Iraq.
Iraq.
Babylon is Iraq now?
Yes. The ruins of the city of Babylon are in Iraq. Tower of Babel, Iraq. Shinar, Iraq. Abraham came from Iraq. Medes. Who are the Medes today? They don't really have a country. They're divided up into other countries. Some are in Turkey, some are in Persia, and some are in Iraq. We call them the Kurds.
Are they the ones that's in the northern part that have kind of their own?
Yes. Right. They're descended from the Medes. The Persians are today Iranians. So this is Iran. If you talk to Americans who are from here, they don't like to say they're Iranians because of the negativity. They'll say they're Persian. Now you understand why they had the wars that go on in the Middle East between each other. It has to do with these things that go to the past. Who was trying to exterminate the Kurds? The Persians or the New Babylonians? It was Saddam. The Iraqi was trying to get rid of the Kurds, not the Persians. They defend them. 5, the Greek, Alexander, died at 33, conquered the world, overpowered this kingdom, and expanded it to include Greece. The Romans then defeated the Greek. The Greek were the originators of where we get our roots of our democracy from. Just as we're falling, they fell. Became corrupt, immoral. Homosexuality wasn't just accepted, it was a preferred and elevated lifestyle, and they were considered gods. We're getting to that point. The Roman borrowed much from Greece. If you look at the architecture, it was the Greek that developed much of the great architecture and things, and it was copied by the Romans. They even took a lot of the marble and the pillars and things right out of the Greek Empire and brought it to Rome and built Rome. Rome fell from within. They had slaves, people from other parts of Europe where our people came from, and we were barbarians. We weren't very civilized, but Rome was. And they had games and big amphitheaters for all kinds of activities. They were very brutal. They didn't like to go and see a sporting event unless somebody got injured and killed, kind of like what we like to see in football and hockey and things. We have a very strong parallel to Rome if you study the decline of Rome. Rome didn't fall overnight. It took 200 or 300 years before it really fell. But they had all these, quote, illegal aliens there. And eventually, because they were so busy in their gluttony and their immorality, that they became weak. And these other people who were doing their fighting and everything for them eventually decided they're going to take Rome. And they did. Rome split into two separate kingdoms, the East and the West. And as the Catholicism was going, it was split into the Eastern and the Western. Western zone is Roman Catholicism, headquarters in the Vatican, and the Eastern are headquartered in different countries. You have the Russian Orthodox, the Armenian Orthodox, and the Greek Orthodox are the main three. And the Pope has been trying to unite all of the Catholic, but they have some major differences. They have calendar differences, holiday differences, and some other things. Now, that's all taken place, and what came out of this sixth one was what we know today as the European states, or you can call it countries. And then the seventh is in progress. It's the revived Roman Empire. Or kingdom. United Europe is what it is. But it's not fully united yet. They have a common currency and passport, but still they don't have all the power of the government centralized. It's in place, but the courts in England still are functioning in some other countries, and it isn't out of Brussels where they're having the final say, but they have a Supreme Court for all of Europe and so on. And they have a president, but it's kept pretty quiet. We don't hear a lot about it. It's out of that, we believe the Bible teaches that the Antichrist will rise out of the revived Roman Empire. The false prophet is coming from the land, meaning Israel, will probably be a Jewish background person. But because of the religious structure, it's believed that that person will be the Pope. There is a cardinal who is Jewish. He wasn't elected this time, but he's very favored. That is some possibilities. So this is in progress. And then there will be an eighth one, and that is when the Antichrist takes control of the revived Roman Empire. And we have the empire of the Antichrist. Very short-lived. And then we have the ninth, is that of Jesus Christ, return, and the millennium. And we'll get more detail about this. But you need to keep that structure in mind because it really helps to understand Daniel and other prophecies. Just think of all this history of thousands of years to take place with all of these, getting us up to seven. We have this to go, and eighth is a short 7-year reign.
Have we begun in it after the past?
No, we're in number seven. The revived Roman Empire is not fully powered up yet because there's too many old people that don't like the idea of losing their sovereignty as being a British person. The British are holding out the most. I'm just going to throw something in for conjecture. I'm not going to quote references to this. But just as God used the Assyrians to discipline the northern kingdom and the Babylonians the southern kingdom, then why not would God not use somebody to discipline the United States of America and Europe, where God has blessed with the gospel and we've turned against God? Europe is ahead of us in turning against God. Some of the big churches in London that used to send out missionaries in the 1800s are mosques today. Our president, and I voted for him twice, but our president has actually acknowledged Islam, has gone to a Muslim center in Washington, taken his shoes off, and paid homage to Allah. Put a Quran in the White House. Put the Saudi flag in our national airport that says, in Arabic, Allah is supreme. And you think that our God is going to sit by? No. I believe that when he's out of office, he's going to suffer personal tragedies. And hopefully God will spare our nation. But let me just show you something here. If you study what's going on with Islam, and how so many people, even Christians, are saying we have to make friends and unify our faith, which is like trying to put Jesus and Satan together, and we can have world peace. Now, the Bible doesn't teach that at all. Because when Jesus came the first time, he said, I didn't come to bring peace, I came to bring what?
He came to bring dissension.
Right. Division. Right. Absolutely. Between what?
Between good and evil.
Between good and evil. He came to redeem us. And he had to show us that we needed to be redeemed, right? He said there will even be divisions in the family. I have divisions in my family over Christianity, and yet I was raised in a home that went to church, and yet there's division with my father, not my mother, but my father. He has his own religion, he says. Yet we can love people through Christ, certainly. Every time there is division in your families and friends and, well, whatever, you know it's Satan in the middle of it. Those people don't know what they're doing. Absolutely. I believe that God is using the Muslims. I really do. And I think he's blinded people today in Holland, the Netherlands. And you know, they used to send out a lot of missionaries. They had an empire in the world, the Dutch, all over the world. The Dutch East Indies, Indonesia, Shell Oil, all that. God had blessed them. Well, they spread the gospel. Now they're one of the most pagan nations. You go to Amsterdam, you can get drugs. You can go down to a certain section of beautiful store windows with half-naked women sitting in there, pick out which one you want. Homosexuality is open and accepted and so on. It's just decadent. And we know as believers that the old nature desires these things, but what happens? Do they bring happiness?
No.
They bring destruction, because Satan is a destroyer. So I think God's allowing this. There are 50% of the Netherlands are now Muslim. Now, one of the legislatures actually went on record by saying we must ban Islam, the religion. It's a religion of hatred and murder, and it really is.
I vote for that.
It really is. God is so wise. Even though he used the Babylonians and took Daniel into captivity, what happened to Nebuchadnezzar? Eventually he did what? Repented and received the God of Daniel. I think the same thing pattern is going to happen. The Bible has patterns that repeat themselves. Yes, we shouldn't be afraid. And we're going to be disciplined through them. As that is happening, a number of them are going to come to Christ. That's why we shouldn't fear it, but we need to know more about Islam and these things, because God is probably going to put a Muslim in all of our lives at some point, at a store or whatever, and how we relate to them is our witness. But I think that's what's going on right now in our lifetime, because Islam is creeping through the whole world. And we have sat by and allowed them to kill millions of Christians, born-again believers in Africa and Indonesia and Philippines. And their plan is to do the same thing in Europe, the U.S., Canada. Why do you think they got certain people over here? They're trying to find out where the Jews are, because they say they will kill the Saturday people first and the Sunday people second. We're the Sunday people. That's their plan. But remember what God does? He takes the evil schemes of the devil and does what? Brings glory and honor to himself. But we shouldn't fear it. Now, we could suffer some pretty difficult times in this, but remember, God is going to be triumphant. His purpose is not to destroy. It's to get us to do what? The one word that describes all revelation starts with an R. God's looking for what?
Repentance.
Somebody want to tell us what repentance means? There are two parts to repentance. It has to do with turn. You turn away from something and turn towards? Okay, away from?
Evil.
Okay, away from evil or sin and to God. So you're going this way, you make a U-turn.
Would you have to acknowledge the sin and deal with it and then come back to turn towards God? Because if you just turn towards God, you're not dealing with this. And Satan will use that to get you to feel that you're not right with God, and it messes you all up. Some people get mad and they just walk away from the Bible and everything else. Satan wins victory.
We'll be studying chapter 1. It's found on page 4 of your outline. Roman numeral 4, key concepts for chapter 1. Notice under A1, when studying prophecy, it is important to keep in mind that there are many time gaps of several years between each event. It's like standing on the top of a large mountain range and seeing only the peaks of each mountain.
Let's give some examples of that. Colorado might be a good place. Some are higher than others. So you're standing up in here. Because of the distance, it's very hard to see all this, but you can see this and this and this. But you don't know how far it is here. All these things have to take place. And so you see boom, boom, boom. This prophecy says that this is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. You think it's right succession, or it could be hundreds of years between these. God has many times given us just the basic mountaintops. He hasn't given us a lot of detail. And yet you can go to another part of the Bible, and He's given us something down in here. Another part, He's given us something over here, and something here, and here, and here, and you have to put it all together. Actually, to understand some real details about the types of Antichrist, Antiochus Epiphanes, the out of Syria, and we'll get into the whole thing of this, I had to go to the book of Maccabees, which is not an inspired book, but it's one of the Apocrypha books, because that's a history of this man conquering and what he did. Because that will give us things down in here. And that's why the Bible is confusing to people, because God didn't start down here and right up to here and down and down. It doesn't work that way chronologically. Now, Kings and Chronicles and Samuel and some of those are fairly chronological in Genesis. But there are big time gaps between Adam and Noah. It wasn't just the next year. There's a long time in there, and sometimes it's hard to determine exactly how much time it was. And between Noah and Abraham was a long time. Isaac and Jacob came right along, generations. So that's why it becomes confusing, but I want you to understand that. As we see Daniel, we're just going to see just glimpses of things, and then at times we're going to get some real details about some of these. Don't get frustrated there. How about number 2? It actually opens up the book of Daniel, verses 1 through 5. Nebuchadnezzar is coming to Judea himself and going to deal with the nation of Israel that's left, which is the southern kingdom. The rest have gone to the Assyrians when he's conquered the Assyrians. So let's read verses 1 through 5.
Daniel chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service.
King shows up. We know exactly who the king of the southern kingdom was at that time, right? It mentions his name. And then it says that somebody gave them over. Yeah, isn't that something? That proves that God is in control. God allowed 9/11 to take place, and we've had lots of warnings. And we've had a lot of more warnings about treating Israel and about returning to the Bible, and yet I heard recently that in California, many of the big hotels are taking the Gideon Bibles out and replacing them with Gore's book on environmentalism.
Hmm. Also, today on the news, they're talking about one of the counties in California where the schools, the classrooms were 33% Islamic. And so now they're having a dispute over celebrating Halloween and Christmas and stuff like that. And this woman got up and said that she feels that they celebrate their high holiday, which I'm so they go ahead now, they're not embracing any of the other holidays. But in those schools they are going to
the Eid, is it the Eid? Ramadan, that and the Ramadan. That means that the kids will be fasting during the day and partying all night. So you might as well shut down the school. And then historically we have Daniel and his friends and others, it doesn't mention who they are, but there are others, are taken to Babylon. Now how are they treated on this journey? It doesn't say directly, but how can we imply the fact that they must have treated them well? Because they said, find the best, good-looking, intelligent, not with blemish, from the royal family and others, and take them back. So they were treated very delicately. After they got there, they were offered stuff off the king's table. That's the validation of it. But what else did Nebuchadnezzar take with? Vessels, which would be objects. They were sacred objects, weren't they? And they were taken from the temple. But now let's think this through. Why would God allow that to be taken, which means they could not practice Judaism? Because those sacred items were being taken by the king of Babylon, the so-called enemy. What was going on in the temple before the king of Nebuchadnezzar? The temple is already desecrated. God says, I'm not going to even leave that for you because I'm going to use it later in the rebuilt temple. So I'm going to put it into safekeeping by your enemy. And Nebuchadnezzar honored that. He took it and put it away. It wasn't until his son got into it and desecrated it. And then God brought his kingdom down. Tells us a lot of things right there in the setting.
Yeah, it helps kind of helps to get in there as if you were, and what, you know, how you would feel if that happened in the era.
Going on the basis that God is for family, what did God do for Daniel? Didn't say his mom and dad went with. They were young people. Daniel and his three friends. Not acquaintances. Friends. He had moral support. His intimacy and friendship was brought with. You cannot have more than three or so close friends, true, close, intimate friends. You cannot, because you don't have intimacy. If you share all your details of hurts, pains, and struggles in your life with a lot of people, you have no intimacy. And those people will not guard that, protect your heart. They'll share it. They're bored and they want to share something. So I look at it this way, that his inner circle. In other words, it was like a family for him and for those other three. And they had the rest of their life together. And they were on a roller coaster of a great adventure. A great adventure. They were in the heart of world history. Of God's working through the nation of Israel to discipline them. But yet he protected them because he had a great purpose to evangelize their enemies. Isn't that cool? Can you think of modern day situations where that has happened? Where God has allowed people to be taken into captivity in a sense, martyred, and it's had a tremendous positive result for God. I can think of several. How about Gilead and the other four that were murdered in Ecuador? I heard a message on that, and they estimate that 40,000 young people committed themselves to missionaries to go to the hard-to-reach places as a result of that. It didn't scare people, it rose them up. And their children and wives went back, and the tribe today, they're evangelizing all over the earth. Now, Daniel's life looked like it was going to be forfeited, but God pulled him through. It doesn't mean that God's going to pull through all the time, and it doesn't mean that they didn't lack faith. They had guns. They could have shot those guys with those machetes. But they had vowed that they would never use that other than for hunting game. And they stood there and got hacked up. If they weren't like Daniel, to start with, I'm sure they would have been tempted to start using a gun, at least one of those. But they had already made the commitment. To me, that's the beginning message for Daniel here, for us. It's that be committed before the storm. Don't try to get committed in the middle of the storm. I think it's going to be a very exciting study. The sad thing to me is that people get hung up in, quote, interpreting the Bible. It depends on how you interpret it. You'll find people that don't want to pay attention to the Bible. I said, no, your problem is not the interpretation. Your problem is obedience. You don't want to accept the fact that you're a sinner and you're going to have to deal with your sin or you're going to let God deal with it. That's the real issue. Because the Bible interprets itself. These dreams are all interpreted. There is no guessing. But to apply them to the historical setting, yes, and putting several together to come up with a complete timeline of something, yes, that's what I've tried to do. So it's not fragmented. Did Daniel ever go back to Judah? What country was he in when he died? Was he in Babylon? No, the Babylonians were overpowered by the Medo-Persian, and he was taken to Persia. And when he went in the lion's den, he was in Persia at 85. And he died 2 years later at 87. So Daniel never returned. He spent most of his life in captivity. But he had quite a journey of becoming very high up in these kingdoms, right? Yeah.
Daniel in Nebuchadnezzar's court are verses 6 through 21. Somebody like to read.
Among these were some from Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names, to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus.
What to you is significant? Why does God have those verses in the Bible? What is God wanting us to know?
The best is the best.
Okay. There's something about that. Do you think that Daniel and his friends knew of the complete plan that Nebuchadnezzar had? Do you think he revealed the whole plan and what he was going to do with them?
I doubt he revealed the whole plan, but I think he revealed part of it.
Do you think that they knew that he was trying to make Babylonians out of them?
Yes. But why would that one be? Because he was going along with it. And if he would have, they would have done some of these things, it would have gone against the Lord.
Yes. Now that's the bottom line of this whole thing right there. In the New Testament, we have a verse when Jesus was being criticized falsely by telling people they shouldn't pay taxes to Caesar and so on. He never said that, but they tried to accuse him. The Pharisees tried to trap him so they could get rid of him. He said, "Give me a coin." What was the lesson? Whose picture is on this coin? Mine? No. Caesar. He said, "Render or give unto Caesar that which belongs to Caesar, and to God that which belongs to God." There is a very strong line. And sometimes it's blurred for us as to what is God's and what is Caesar's. That's what Daniel was facing prior to that whole presentation by Jesus, but the concept is the same. Daniel had to decide when it was appropriate to obey the king and his rulers, and when it was important to obey God if there was a contradiction. I can give you an example that I was faced with when I was looking into directing a boys' ranch in Nebraska years ago. Actually, God used me to go there and find that the man that was running this and kind of owned it actually was a crook. He was a pastor, but he was a crook. And he was abusing these boys and people there to make lots of money for himself. One of the missionaries, we went to another town, as you know how sparse the population is, and we had to get some parts or something, and he said, "Would you ride with me?" I said, "Yes." He said, on the way, he said, "I don't know you very well, but in my heart, I feel I can trust you." I said, "Well, I appreciate that, and I hope you can. I will try." He said, "I'm very confused because I know I'm to honor the authority, Mr. Walker. But somebody donated many, many, many dozen pairs of jeans, brand new, and they're stored in a shed. He came to me and said, 'I want to use that shed for storing something. I want you to take all those jeans out in the field and burn them.'" He said, "I told him, next time I go to Omaha to pick up another kid or something, I'll take them to a mission." He said, "No, I am ordering you to get the boys in your home to get out there, pour gas on them, and burn them." So he said, "This is what I did, and I don't know if I did right. Yes, we took them out to the field. I took a can of gas, and I took a book of matches. I laid it there. I called them up and said, 'It's done. It's in the field. If you want to burn it, you light the match.'" I said, "You did exactly the right thing. You did. You honored God where God should be honored, and you honored Caesar where Caesar should be honored." I said, "You are wise." Don't you think he did the right thing? Yeah.
Did the guy go out and do it?
Oh, yeah. He exposed so many things that I turned him into the IRS because he actually had bought a huge ranch and built a mega house. And nobody in the area knew how he got the money. Well, he was stealing it out of this boy's ranch.
Were those jeans bothering him?
He needed that building to store
but
something.
But couldn't he give them away?
Sure.
Sure. The man was sick. Sick. Yeah. I think they get blinded. And I think God called me there to expose that. Because when it came to negotiating for our salary, he said, you can have what you want. And the only reason he was bringing somebody in is his father had a heart attack and had a big ranch and all these cattle, and he couldn't run three ranches. So he wanted me to become part of this corruption, very obviously. I looked through some of the records. He violated state law. They gave thousands of dollars for rehab, and he never did anything. He had the facilities, but he said, these kids need rehab to get out and work. I said, no, they need love and counseling and care. So I told him, if I came here, you have to separate your personal stuff from this ranch. The ranch will not pay your phone bills, whatever, and your food. There was a butcher in town that would slaughter some of their pigs and cattle so that they could put it in the freezer for these boys for the ranch. And there were several churches that gave money. He would throw his cows in there, too, and get everything free. Well, I got back here, and a message on my phone says, well, I've been kind of nervous about you, and I have to recheck you out, you know, blah, blah, blah. I called him back. I said, yeah, I'm sure you're nervous because you're a crook and you know it. And I want you to prove to me that you're going to straighten this matter out. Well, he didn't. So I called the IRS because I knew that they could take his ranch away from him more than likely. And when I called them, they said, we can't tell you anything. We've been suspicious. I called the state, and they said, we knew something was going on there, and we could never prove it. And I said, well, here's how you can prove it. And he held the missionaries captive because he didn't give them their salary, because they couldn't even afford to get gas to get out of there. And they wanted to leave, and they were scared. So that was an example where this young family man, here Daniel now, his name is changed to Belshazzar. That's a Babylonian name. If you study the meaning of those names, they relate to the gods of Babylon. He didn't make a fuss over that because he knew who he was with God. People can call you anything they want, right? They can rename you. They can call you self-righteous. They can call you a born-again believer. Or as I've heard some people say, you're a fundamentalist. That's how they pronounce that word. Understand why they're saying that. Because of our belief in that reflection, it convicts them. They're angry at themselves, not us personally. So Daniel didn't take issue with that. But when it came to this food off the king's table, that was supposed to honor them. The king's intention was to honor them. He wasn't really to defile them, I don't believe. But Daniel drew the line, and he said, because that has been sacrificed to a pagan god. And the Jewish tradition, God said, too, you don't eat that which has been sacrificed. That's of gods. You don't take gods, right? So he was following Judaism. He wasn't just defiling the king. So my point here is that Daniel was who Daniel was before he got there, and he remained the same basic person. On the inside. It's just like when I was in Saudi Arabia, I trained about 300 young Saudi guys. And after we got to know each other and they got to trust me, and I would go into different classrooms, and we had a table like this in the center of each classroom where they could conference. And I'd sit down and say, if anybody's through with their work, come and talk to me. And I did that every day in different classes. And after a while, of course, the whole class would be there, and they loved to share. And I asked all about their families and everything. And finally, when we did certain things, like take pictures, one kid said, no, if my dad sees my picture, he'll kill me. Well, at first I didn't realize it was literal. It was literal. That's why you don't have juvenile. Out of Michigan, where there are a lot of Muslims, there was a 911 call from this girl, teenage girl, and I think it was to talk to a non-Muslim boy in high school or something. She got the phone call off because her parents were starting to kill her. And the phone did not get disconnected. They thought they disconnected, but they didn't. So the recording is going, and you hear her pleading for her life as they are stabbing her to death.
all in the name of Allah. So it happens. They estimate that about 1,000 girls a year in the Middle East are raped. 10, 11, 12-year-old girls are raped. And according to the custom, if there's no witness, they are executed. They're executed. The victim, because she's contaminated. That's how evil it is. But Daniel was faced in the middle of all this. And he had this line drawn before he even got there. Because he was living that life in Judah. Even though Judah had started to go away from God, he didn't. As our churches and our nation go from God, we don't have to. Right? And someday we may be faced with this line very strongly. Are you going to spit on your Bible or are you going to get shot? That's happened in places. Really, I'm serious.
I know.
You have to believe that God will protect you. That if He wants you to live, you're going to live and no one can touch you. But if He decides that's the way to take you home, it's going to be a painless thing. Look at Stephen being stoned. He had a smile on his face, looked up to heaven and asked God to forgive him. And they thought he was an angel. They were shocked. I think that God and many of the martyrs has removed their spirit and soul partly from that body so they don't experience the horrors of the physical mutilation. I personally believe that. But you see, it's when you're in comfort in your home territory is when you need to have the lines dealt with. That's the big message here. And you'll see that Daniel didn't change the things. Oh, I forgot about these Muslim guys. So as we were talking, I said, do you really believe these things and all this prayer and all these things and so on and so forth? You know what they told me? We are Muslims there, not here. We're Muslims on the outside, but not in the inside. And I'll bet you today, if they had freedom, they would lose 90% of their followers, especially of the young people, which is the majority of the population. They've seen the hypocrisy of it. But fear of being killed. That's simple. People can just be hauled out. Just like the Nazis came and took people. That's the way they do it. You're here today and gone tomorrow. But how did he approach it? Don't put that stuff on in front of me. No, how did he approach it? And that's our lesson.
Well, he asked them not to make himself too violent, though.
He asked. Yes, he didn't tell. He asked. Would the king allow us, instead of saying we don't want this crap, he said, see if the king will let us eat vegetables and fruit, and then after 10 days, to see if we aren't healthier. Because what did the king want of these guys? To be sick?
No, he wanted them to be healthy.
Yeah. So they were trying to do what to the king? No.
Teach.
Teach. Teach. Not to accommodate, but to teach. Just think of the great messages like Ilya, when he and his four missionaries were slaughtered in Ecuador. What did the wives and the children do? They went there sometime later and told those people who killed their husbands, we forgive you. They were teaching them forgiveness. Aunt melted them. And today, that tribe is going all over South America witnessing the people. Yes, it took lives. And that's true all over the world. Do you remember when, I don't know what skirmish it was, but we were monitoring, I think, the Iraq-Iranian war, an Iraqi fighter pilot shot down, sprayed bullets on one of our ships in the Arabian Gulf there. And some of these sailors were killed or something, or shot down on our planes or something. And the widow sent a Bible to that pilot with a message in Arabic saying, I forgive you because you don't really know what you're doing. and here's why I forgive you. And that got all over the world. Today they wouldn't publicize that, but it got into the main news of the impact that it had on many of the Iraqis.
They never experienced something.
No, forgiveness is not an Islamic thing at all. I don't want to get too sidetracked, but think of Joseph when he saw his brothers. He had compassion, he wept, but he tested them for one reason, not for vengeance, but to see if they had repented. Were they sorrowful for what they had done to him? And when he realized that they were, and revealed himself to them. Now, can you imagine a shepherd? Because the Egyptians hated shepherds. They stink, too. I don't know if you've ever seen it. They do. Sheep are dirty things, especially the south end. The south end. When the sheep's heading north and you're in the south end, they are dirty. They need a car wash to keep those things clean. I lived next door to a place where there was a shepherd living in a shack taking care of sheep in Saudi Arabia. And a guy would pull up in a big Mercedes, obviously the owner, and go and deal with this guy or whatever. I thought, man, what a life this guy had. I wasn't a Christian then. I wish I were at that time. I would have witnessed to it. Hopefully somebody did. So what did Joseph say after he revealed himself? I am Joseph, your brother, the prince of Egypt and the world at that time. How could they believe it? But Benjamin, his true brother, recognized him. He said, one thing, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. He said that something is what over vengeance. Forgiveness is greater than vengeance, and compassion is more powerful than, what's the other word?
Anger.
And we have the same kind of thing here, because Daniel and Joseph were similar, that you don't hear any criticisms of them from God. And that's not true of a lot of characters in the Bible. Sure, they were sinners because they were like us, but you didn't have them getting off track. So that's what's really going on here, is that he is teaching the authorities of Babylon by asking, by being respectful. No, I'm not going to eat that. My religion says this. How many Christians say those things and turn people off?